Good evening, lovelies. Welcome to another episode of Coffee, Candy, and Creatives. My creative tonight is Gil Causey. His new book, Let the Wind Carry Me, is available now. Please check him out. Tonight's episode is sponsored by Hollywood Green Botanical Vodka. You can get more information about this drink at hollywoodgreenvodka.com. So grab a cup of coffee, or maybe a cocktail, cuddle up with your host, Pup, and enjoy the show.
What shall we do with a drunken sailor? What shall we do with a drunken sailor? What shall we do with a drunken sailor? Her lie in the morning. Hooray, and up she rises. Hooray, up she rises. Hooray, and up she rises. Her lie in the morning. Put him in the longboat till he's sober. Put him in the longboat till he's sober. Put him in the longboat till he's sober. Her lie in the morning. Hooray, and up she rises. Hooray, and up she rises. Hooray, and up she rises. Her lie in the morning. That's what we do with a drunken sailor. That's what we do with a drunken sailor. That's what we do with a drunken sailor. We're lying in the morning.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine.
Oh, it's so good to talk to you. I was just reading up on you, and I was going like this. And all the things you have been through, even just at the first part of your life, I was like, holy cow, you got kidnapped, but we're going to get into all that. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. Thank you.
Good. Are you on the water now?
No. I'm just at home.
Oh, you're landlocked, huh?
Yeah, I was up north last weekend, and I was one of the directors. It was her 80th birthday. So I was with the family, and we were on Matthew Turner. Okay. And it was blowing 25 knots, so we had a lot of wind, and we had a good sail out there.
That's good. That's the ship that you helped build, right?
Yeah, in San Francisco Bay, right.
So I wanted to start out with the fact that you're the very first part of your book, you talk about being adopted, which I feel is such a topic that needs to be talked about. I too am adopted. I'm adopted by my father. My mother is my mother, but he adopted me when I was 3 years old. And also I found out in about the same time that you did, about middle school. And it was almost the same situation, except that my reaction was a little different than yours. I was like, I went to my friend's house at the time, and I said something about your dad, you know, something, something. And she was a teenager, and she was mad about something. He's not my real dad. And I said, oh. So when I went home, I said, Mom, did you know that that's not her real dad? And she goes, well, yeah. And I was like, well, I think I said something along the lines of, I'm glad I don't have that problem or something. And she's like, talk. And but my biological father was never, I met him perhaps twice as an adult and just never was interested in anything. So mm-hmm. A lot, as you say in your book, a lot of adopted children, adults, a lot of adopted children have experiences that are wonderful when they meet their biological family. If they're interested, as you say, some aren't. Some don't care, not in a bad way, don't care, but they're happy where they are. They love their parents, not adoptive parents. They love their parents. But when they do reach out, sometimes they have great experiences. Sometimes they have not so great experiences like I did. Isn't it just such an individual experience?
I think it is an individual decision and individual concept of how you want to relate. You know, I had a good relationship with the parents I had, with my adopted parents, and they were nice people. I never had any real problem. I never rebelled as a teenager. They were very supportive always and never made me want to search out for my biological family. I never had a yearning for that. And it's problematic. I don't know what I would have found. And, you know, I mean, that opens up a whole nother world that you might not want to, you know, visit. And so I just never really went there. I did do that, like I said, the DNA search out of curiosity. But it only brought up maybe some second cousins, third cousins and things like that. And and some of the names I saw on 23andMe, you know, how you relate to these people, other than that you're, you know, through your genetics, is something else. And if you want to search more in that, if you're interested, I guess that's the way to go. But I never felt compelled.
And finding out the 23andMe, you're finding out pretty much what you're made up of, not necessarily where you come from, which is kind of nice.
That's right.
And I think it's at 75% Swiss.
Well, I think Northern European is more accurate. You know, English, Irish, maybe Swiss. Because there was one thing where they said I was distantly related to Hans Griff back in 1528 in Switzerland. I think that was through Ancestry.com. It was interesting. My mom's family on her mother's side was Swiss. I don't know if I was adopted from some family member at some point, or whether it was just isolated in L.A. because her family was mainly up in Northern California.
Right.
And
not to throw you out there with how old you are or anything, but perhaps at the time of your birth in Los Angeles, it might not have been acceptable. Perhaps it was a single mother. You know, all you can do is speculate, really.
Well, there was back then a whole thing about the feelings about unwed mothers and having babies. You know, they were somewhat in disgrace about their position. They weren't, and so they were always encouraged to give up their babies for adoption. And the adoptions were kept secret. And the adoptions, so there was a whole industry actually with that back in the 40s and 50s, I think, adopted children from unwed mothers and or unwanted babies. And so the government kept it a secret. You know, they changed the birth certificates. My birth certificate reads my adopted parents. And so, yes, back then, that's the way it was. You know, I'm 70, I'll be 71 this year. I still feel that, you know, I don't really want to go into that direction. I have my life has been fine without it.
Exactly. It's something you know, but you don't need to know anymore about it.
Yeah.
Maybe you were the child of a starlet.
Well, yeah, there's all kinds of possibilities. That's right. Yeah, I don't think I got the looks of a starlet, but but you know, but yeah, I mean, it's always interesting to wonder what you know about that. But I just leave it at that. You know, just. Right. Just speculation.
And often it's a case of, I'm going to paraphrase it because I'll mess it up, but be careful of peeping through the keyhole. You know, you may not like what you see.
Beware of what you find, yes.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. All right, so seventh grade, your mom's like, oh, you're adopted too. And you're like, cool, figured. Right?
It made sense, yeah.
Yeah, right. You don't resemble? Or you just felt different, maybe?
I think so. I think because we were all so different in many ways, and we didn't look alike. So I think, you know, some people would say, "Oh, you look like your mom," and different things, but you know, not really.
Right. And I can understand that because growing up, I look nothing like my siblings. But if I look closely enough, I can see, oh, well, okay, our nose is the same because we share a mother. But what's ironic is my father is from Spain, from Barcelona. Okay, so I don't look like my siblings. And it's so funny because it's like, take me aside. And then you have a sister, a brother. And it's almost like the dark Spanish looks were diluted. So my brother, who is the youngest, and I resemble each other the most in that we have paler skin and we have lighter eyes. But what's ironic is in Barcelona, if you were to go and see my father's cousins, the family over there, they would look like me, not with blue hair, but they would look like me. They would have like blonde or dirty blonde hair, light eyes, lighter skin. So it's kind of like, if I don't tell anybody, nobody knows. Moving on from adoption, which is, as we said, a personal experience. You graduated high school and you attended a specific type of college, a Quaker college, because you were a conscientious objector in regards to, was that the Vietnam War or just war in general?
Well, I had read, I'd been, you know, I'd read Albert Schweitzer and All Men Are Brothers when I was quite young. And I had a lot of feelings about not wanting to kill people and not not finding that even in wartime to be something that, you know, one should avoid. So by the time the Vietnam War seemed, it seemed more like a business than a war that was, I mean, there was idealism in it, but I just didn't, I was more aligned with the Quakers right. in terms of that's the way to live your life than as a soldier.
Right. I mean, when it comes down to it, again, it's a personal choice or experience. I'm sure that most people would not hesitate to fight to protect them, you know, their family or themselves. But
yeah, absolutely.
It'd be so difficult to sign up knowing that you're going to be, or even not even get signed up at the time, they would choose you and say you're going whether you want to or not, you know, unless you have some sort of exception or exclusion. But to make a choice to become a soldier has to be so difficult. You have to have that idealism and deeply ingrained in you, because that's got to be so difficult.
Well, I had nothing against guys, soldiers that, I mean, yeah, other guys that went to war and or were drafted. I was, I had a high lottery number, so, and plus I was in college. So I never was really vulnerable to that draft. And at Whittier, I even lived with two Vietnam vets. Wow. And they, and you know, one was an MP, had been an MP there. And so I learned about their experiences. I didn't look at them any differently. I mean, they were just people that's what they did and that's what they chose. That's what they had to do and in their lives. And, you know, we all follow a path that sometimes we don't have a lot of choices.
Right.
You know, we do what we have to do in life to make our way. So I didn't look at them any differently than I would have, you know, as someone who didn't go to war.
Right. Sometimes our course is set for us and we cannot fight it.
Yeah.
So you went to Whittier and you were going to do math and you changed your mind.
I did.
And so what did you end up graduating with? I didn't read that part.
I was dual. Well, there was a, I didn't like the math counselor. So I found a counselor in the political science department that I liked. And so I ended up as a dual major in political science and history, which I wasn't thinking that far ahead, but that's good for a lawyer, a politician, yeah. or, you know, or professor, or maybe a writer, you know. And none of those things seemed to make sense after I graduated. So that's why I eventually joined the laborers union and went to work for my dad's company.
Okay. Yeah. And poli sci in the late 60s, early 70s had to be a tough time with the politics of that time period. Like, that's a bold choice, sir. So what, and your dad had his own business and you went to work for him?
Yes.
And then you started buying and selling houses.
I was, they had saved up some money for me in an insurance annuity. And so at 23, I decided to buy my first little house, in Laguna. And, plus it was that the market was doing quite well. That was 73. It was coming out. So there was, it was an inflationary period and, I lucked out. And so I had my house for 2 years and then I sold it, made a profit. And then I moved on and I did that with about five houses in Laguna.
At 23 years old.
Yeah.
I could tell you about some 23-year-olds right now that aren't doing that. That's fantastic.
My dad was really good at helping make me comfortable with that world and learning about the responsibility of taking care of a house and all that. So yeah, I don't know. I just, he just made me comfortable doing it.
So we go from flipping houses in California to getting kidnapped in Costa Rica.
Yeah.
And this was still the 70s?
Well, I had a wanderlust that, you know, started, I think because I met these geologists. I took a geology course and I met all these students that were geologists, and I started going on field trips with them and really loving it, loving the backpacking and the climbing and the exploring and in the outside world. And so I eventually bought a blazer and fixed it up with a bed in the back and a stove and everything, and just started going out when I could in between working just on long trips. That's why I eventually made it up to Alaska. And I was kind of in a way searching for another place, you know, whether I wanted to live there. But after hearing from them how cold it was during the wintertime, I went south.
It is beautiful up there, but cold, yes.
So then I turned south and I ended up going. Actually, I had a grand plan with my buddy. We were going to drive down to Panama, ship the car across on Italia lines to Colombia, drive down to Brazil, ship it across to Africa, go across Africa, come up to Europe, you know.
Wow.
Basically go around the world driving. But when I got to Costa Rica, we got into Limon area, and that's when I got we got kidnapped. And so we lost. Luckily, I negotiated with the kidnappers, and so we lost. I lost half my money, but so we ended up just staying in Costa Rica because it turned out to be a beautiful, wonderful place with great people.
Yeah, kidnapping does kind of put a damper on your world tour.
Changes track.
Yeah, I heard that Costa is very beautiful. I heard that they have big bugs as well.
I don't remember the bugs so much. I just remember the people being just very educated and very, very happy and fun to be with.
So how, after all of your wanderlust, your traveling, you found that place you wanted to stay put for a little while, or you ended up back in California?
I came back up to California with the intention of selling my Laguna house and moving to Costa Rica. Mm-hmm. But once I got back up to California, I had doubts about making that decision. And one thing was, I didn't know whether I wanted to be an expatriate, you know, living in a foreign country, you know, a foreigner in a foreign country. And my sister had moved to Hawaii, so that's why I decided to go there.
That was your sister Nancy?
My sister Nancy, yeah. So I went over there and visited with her and everything and fell in love with the island. And I'd been to Hawaii when I was younger, so I was not unfamiliar with it. And the people, but once I got over there, I realized this is a nice place too. And I was always into sailing and boating a lot. So when I moved there, I don't know whether I saw the potential of it or not, but when I moved there, eventually I needed to figure out how to get out on the water. And that's when I found Nancy Griffith. She was teaching a course of celestial navigation at a marine store. And I thought, that sounds really interesting. So that's when I met her and then we became friends, and she asked me to crew, and I started crewing for her for the Oceanic Society and doing charters.
And this was on a sailboat or a?
It was on a 42-foot wooden catch.
Okay, wow. Now, celestial navigation, that's using the astrolabe and all that?
It's just a sextant.
A sextant, okay.
A sextant and a chronometer.
Oh, wow.
That's all you need. And obviously you need the tables to figure out the equations.
Right. And a little knowledge of astronomy would probably help.
Where the stars are, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Be like, we're going that way.
Yeah, you learn quickly when you have to, you know, when you have to do your navigation using that. and you get familiar. When you're out there on a long trip, let's say for a month or two, you know, you're staring at the stars every night. So they become your friends, and you get used to where they are and where they are during the different times. And using a celestial navigation, you have a window of about 20 minutes in the morning at dawn and 20 minutes at dusk, because you have to be able to see the horizon as well as the star. Because what you're doing with the sextant is bringing the star down to the level of the horizon, and then that gives you your angle of declination. And that's something you can use in the book to find your line of position. So once getting one sight on a star gives you one line of position. So you usually need two or three stars to get an accurate pinpoint of your location.
See, now I know nothing about it. I would have thought you had to do it at nighttime. So that makes more sense to do it when you can still see. But there's a lot of math in that.
Like, there is a bit of math, yeah.
Oh, I'll leave that to the experts.
they do have little computers now where you can just that helps you with that.
I would have the boat going in circles probably. You said you've been on boats and sailing in the water your entire life, right? I mean, obviously California and then Hawaii, you're surrounded by water. You're close to the water. So as a young child, mom and dad got you up on the boat. And
my dad had two things that that I connected with him when he had time. He was very busy. He was at work a lot. And so there were two things that he wanted to teach me. One was golf, and the other was fishing. So we would go fishing a lot, and eventually he got me out on big fishing boats. He had a friend that had a big fishing boat. We would go out for days at a time, going out albacore fishing. Wow. And we did one trip down to the Sierra Cortez in Mexico. Wow. And we're at 12. I was able to catch marlin and see the big fish. We were tagging and releasing actually back. That was 1964 would have been. I was 14. Anyway, that's where I connected with the ocean and felt very familiar with it. So I'd been going out on the water since I learned to drive a little skiff, little motor skiff at five.
Aw, you. So that brings you down to Hawaii, and where you met Nancy Griffith, and you're crewing for her now on her boat. How does that lead to building a boat?
I crewed for her quite a bit, and then on the Nellie Bly on her catch, and then I decided I wanted to get my own sailboat. Mm-hmm. So I was looking at a sailboat over in Hilo side. And I was negotiating with them, and I'd actually cut the price in half after about 6-7 months of negotiation. And I was just about ready to buy the boat when Nancy called me up and said about going in on a boat together. So we went on this boat together, the Goodwind, which was a 1928 riveted iron boat built by the German Navy as a sail training vessel for sea cadets. So she was a very strong, well-built boat, very, very simple, but not a luxury boat, but a working boat. And so that's when we got into a lot of work with the we got a contract with the University of Hawaii doing the Blue Water Marine Lab program. We worked for the University of Cambridge, taking scientists from Tahiti up to Pitcairn Island, and the Department of Interior taking scientists up to the Northern Hawaiian Island. Anyway, we did a lot of projects. And so eventually she and I started talking, and we decided to form a nonprofit corporation. And we really thought about maybe forming a school, starting a sailing school or an educational school with a school ship. Mm-hmm. But I put that on the back burner because it never seemed quite feasible in Hawaii. There didn't seem the logistics, the people and the support to build something like that. I mean, it really takes, as I learned, a whole community to make it work. And so anyway, that was on the back burner. And so subsequently we didn't do anything about that until eventually, I met this Alan Olson up in the Bay Area, San Francisco, on, I was invited to go on a schooner race, and he was the captain. And so I met Alan, and then he started telling me about his dream of building a school ship. We were aligned in our thinking in terms of our goal, in terms of what we would like to do, in terms of our legacy, in terms of what we would like to give back to the world, you know? So that's where it started. And so I gave some money and to support the project. And then I got deeper and deeper into it. And it was amazing. There was hundreds and hundreds of people, of volunteers who were willing to work on the boat. There was conservation groups that donated lumber from the timberlands that they were managing. Fallen timber that they dug, a lot of Douglas fir and different types of woods to us. In fact, the whole ship's made out of mainly Douglas fir, and it's all mainly donated bone. In fact, they donated, for our use, just temporarily, a saw that would take a log and turn it into boards. And wow. So we had people that knew how to do that. And and plus we were building an old fashioned type of rig, a brigantine. And it's more, the rig on it is more old world. So you had to find people who knew how to do that type of rigging. Mm-hmm. And so the whole process was quite an adventure.
And a passion project, gosh.
Yes, it was. It was, it was from our hearts.
And so it was like a voluntary, the donation of the materials and the donation of that knowledge and expertise and just the donation of the labor of people wanting to work on it, to sand boards or to paint or, and this was from the ground up. This was from plans to on the water.
Yeah, it was, extremely lucky, you know, and it seemed right in a community like Sausalito that used to be an old boat building place years ago. But there were so many people that were supportive and excited about being involved in this project. A lot of retired people, a lot of young people, a lot of all kinds of people from all walks of life.
Right.
And it's amazing how everybody came together to build something that they saw as important for the community. And we were lucky, too, that the Bay Model, which is the Army Corps of Engineers in the Sausalito area, that the director was also supportive and on the board of our organization to give us a place to dock the boat.
Because that's where a lot of the money comes in, or where it goes out, I should say, is docking.
No, we don't pay anything.
No, but I'm saying if you were to have to,
yes,
if they had been kind enough to donate the space to you. I know a lot of people that have given up on having their boats because of it. So the fact that they were kind enough to donate that space to you, that's wonderful.
Absolutely. That would be an enormous expense if we had to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. So this was what year now? And this is the Matthew Turner, right?
That's right.
All right. And what year was the completion?
Well, we got certified by the Coast Guard last year in July.
Last year? Oh my gosh.
And we've been busy doing things. Even during the pandemic, we were able to operate a bit and then later pick up things towards the end of the year. And we have a good, a lot of bookings and season ahead. So we've been the most active school ship in the country, tall ship.
Well, I was going to ask, you said you were certified by the Coast Guard July 2020, and the boat was completed around the same time?
Yes, yeah, before that. And we'd had to do sea trials, and we had to do a certain, you know, things for the Coast Guard stability test and things like that. I would say the completion was when we got certified to do service.
Right. But I'm imagining you guys, it's March 2020. You got, yes, the finish line, it's close. We can see it. Hi, COVID. Hello, pandemic. So you get certified by the Coast Guard, and you said you've got bookings already, but can you not start? You can't start yet because of the pandemic, or?
Well, we could do, you know, exercises and different things with the boat. We eventually were able to, do 30 people on board, as permitted by the Coast Guard, with people wearing masks and certain protocols that, you know, that we needed to have in. And then, but things are even looking better now.
Wow. And when you say school boat, you'll probably have to correct me because I'm picturing a bunch of students going to school while at sea, but this is for research purposes and taking students out.
For instance, we have a program where it's called Women Aloft. And we help train women to go up into the yards and furl the sails.
Okay.
That are willing or interested in doing that. So when the Seaward, which is the other boat that belongs to Call of the Sea, that had been running for about 10 years, maybe longer than that now, but. When they were down in Mexico in 2019 during the winter time, and on their way home, they needed to make it back to, you know, this is in January, February, or somewhere back then of 2020, and so the captain was a male captain, but the rest of the crew were all women. And so there's a lot of we have it open to whoever wants to do it. There's no delineation, but we really want to take kids at risk. We want to take open it up and expose people that might not ever or think about having an opportunity to have that opportunity.
I didn't even think of that application. Oh my gosh, you could take these underserved and underprivileged kids. You could even do kids with special needs.
Yeah, we're making it possible so that we can take even people in wheelchairs, if we need to.
That's my heart right there. I didn't even think about that application, because get them out on the water, get them in that fresh air and that sunshine and that salt spray and those healing elements. Get them out of, you know, maybe the dark or the, you know, the oppressive or the bad situations that they may or may not be in. Oh my gosh, that's amazing, Terry.
What the being on the ocean exposed to me, and be, you know, and climbing mountains and running down rivers and all that stuff, they're all great experiences. Mine has been sailing on the ocean and being on the ocean, and you know, the elements take you out of yourself. Mm-hmm. And connect you with the rest of the world. That's something a lot of people need, and they don't really have that opportunity much living in cities or living in restricted lives.
And nature heals us, doesn't it? It's hard to be inside of yourself when there's so much beauty surrounding you and so many just like tactile sensations and experiences going on. It's hard to be focused on, you know, maybe your anxiety or you got a D on your report card. It's hard to be focused on that when nature is just taking you out and healing you, you know, so much just by being in it. That's fantastic.
We are a part of it. And I think a lot of people always feel disconnected from their world. And this hopefully helps connect them to it.
Yeah, it's hard to stay disconnected when you get a splash of salt water in your face.
Exactly.
You hit that riff. And it could be seen as a type of therapy.
It is. It's a wonderful therapy. It's, I think it does a lot of different things for different people. But one thing it does do, it uplifts them from whatever situation, you know, or mental state that they're at, and kind of redirects them into possibilities that they might not have realized.
Right. And you might get a kid from the inner city or from, you know, some concrete jungle has that knack, has that affinity for sailing or for fishing or for, you know, making knots, you know, and they would have no way of knowing that.
For instance, we did some work in the Hawaiian Islands taking the Sea Cadets. They were kids at risk that weren't doing very well in high school. So they'd go into a special class to learn to become Sea Cadets where they could work aboard cruise ships and things like that. So we would take them from Maui or the Big Island over to Oahu to the Coast Guard station to get their green cards. And their green cards allow them to work on board these ships. But when I saw these kids, you know, some that were, you know, there were a lot of different types of personalities. Some had blue hair and different things, you know, there was a hierarchy amongst them in some ways, you know, in which some kids were more dominant. Well, that whole thing dynamic changed when they were on board. Because all of a sudden, the person that used to be in charge or used to be dominant maybe got seasick. Mm-hmm. And the younger one or someone that didn't have, you know, much status, you know, all of a sudden, had status because they were able to cope and handle, you know, steering and all of a sudden the dynamic of the whole group changed.
Right. You got that one tough kid that's terrified of heights and the other one scrambling up to... Wow.
That's right. So changing that dynamic in a kid's life is wonderful to see.
It's all about letting them see something, a possibility.
Possibilities. That's it.
But man, I'm excited. People can learn more about the Matthew Turner and about booking classes and trips.
Yeah, just Google Call of the Sea or Matthew Turner. Mm-hmm. In San Francisco or Sausalito, and you know the site will come up.
I'm really excited about it. I mean, gosh, what a concept! Education, just broadening people's horizons, no pun intended, showing them possibilities that they might not have been aware of. And this, I'm talking about children. I'm talking about adults. You put somebody out there, and they might have been dreaming or feeling or needing something that just answered all the questions that they've had for most of their life.
I think it affects all ages, and you know that it's amazing. I've seen wonderful things happen with different people and different ages there. So it's great to be able to you know, it changed my life. So you know, I feel indebted to maybe, you know, sharing that, and you know, and so this has been a great project that I've been involved in.
Well, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you, Terry.
It's been nice to talk to you too. And you know, it's interesting. There's all kinds of feelings about, you know, adopted kids, and you know, and there's quite a few of us out there.
Yes, sir. There absolutely is, you know? And we're all different.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, okay. bring your son.
I will. We're gonna go on a boat, buddy. All right, have a good day, Terry.
Yeah, you too. Bye-bye.
Thank you guys so much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Gil. As always, be sure to like, follow, and support my beautiful partners over at beunique.org. That's BUNEKE.org. You can find Pup Duffy on pretty much all social media. You can follow the show on Facebook at Coffee, Candy, and Creatives. Again, a big thanks to Hollywood Green Botanical Vodka for sponsoring Gil's episode. Check it out at hollywoodgreenvodka.com. Stay safe, love each other, and I'll see you soon.